The comment period on the exposure draft prepayment features with negative compensation ended on 24th May. At this meeting, we have two papers for the board in relation to the ED. Paper 3A, a summary of comment letters, and paper 3B, a paper that sets the direction for the board's re-deliberation and project plan. I will summarize the key points of paper 3A first. Paper 3A is a summary of all comment letters received as of 6th of June 2017, that is 60 comment letters. Since then, we have received two more letters, and those letters do not provide new information that has not been included in the summary. While analyzing the comment letters, the staff observed that many respondents from Europe, Australia, and North America stated that prepayment features with negative compensation are common in certain markets within their jurisdiction. On the other hand, many respondents from Asia, with the exception of Hong Kong, Africa, and Latin America said that such features are not common in their jurisdictions. The board asked all questions in the ED, and I will go through the summary of feedback on each of them. Question one, the board asked whether the board should address the issue. Most respondents supported the board addressing the concerns raised about the prepayment features that may result in negative compensation, and many of them urged the board to finalize the amendment as soon as possible. Question two, the board asked whether the respondents agree with the two eligibility conditions proposed in the ED. Most respondents agreed that the amendment should have a narrower scope, but had mixed views on the proposed eligibility conditions. Nearly all respondents agreed with the first eligibility condition, that is, a financial asset should be consistent with paragraph B4111B and otherwise meet SPPI condition, with the exception that it contains a prepayment feature with negative compensation. However, many of these respondents expressed concern that the basis of conclusion on the ED provide additional guidance on existing requirements of IFRS 9. In particular, the interpretation of the term reasonable additional compensation for early termination of the contract. They said that such guidance is unnecessary and could have unintended consequences on the accounting for other instruments that the ED is not intended to address. On the second eligibility condition, that is insignificant fair value at initial recognition, respondents had mixed views. While some supported the second condition, more than half of the respondents who answered this question disagreed with the second eligibility condition and recommended that it be deleted. As set out in paragraphs 23 to 29 of this paper, concerns about the condition varied. For example, some said the requirement for negative compensation should be the same as the requirements for positive compensation, and others said that the condition is unduly restrictive. As question three, the board asked whether the effective date of this amendment should be set as annual period beginning on or after 2018, the same date as IFRS 9, or a later date. Respondents had mixed views. Many respondents agreed that the proposed effective date of 2018, while others preferred a later effective date of 2019 for the reasons relating to endorsement and or translation activities. Finally, as question four, the board asked whether the respondents agree with the retrospective application of the ED and the specific transition provision. Also, the board asked whether there is any other additional transition provision required if the amendments are applied later than IFRS 9 and any additional provision for first-time adopters. Most respondents supported retrospective application with specific transition provision proposed in the ED. Some respondents who supported an effective date later than 2018 said that any relevant transition provision in IFRS 9 should be available again when the amendments are first applied. for example, the fair value option in applying the effective interest method and impairment. So that was the summary. Do you have any questions about the summary of the comment letters?
On the just a few observations on the comment letters. What struck me the most when I read the comment letters was that people tended to talk about whether they wanted things or not, as opposed to giving us new arguments really about why they wanted things. And the thing that I was most, what the right word is, surprised by was the lack of discussion about what's in IFRS 9 already and the basis for and the foundations for IFRS 9, not the basis, but the foundations for IFRS 9. And the area where I found that the most troubling was, or didn't really help me, was in the discussion about whether or not there should be additional restrictions for negative compensation as opposed to positive compensation. Now, people basically just said there shouldn't be any restrictions because it should be symmetrical, which sounds nice on the face of it. But we all, in my head, conceptually, yes, I always start out wanting things to be symmetrical as well. But we were very specific, I thought, on the basis to point out why some of us, at least, were troubled by just having all negative compensation included. And that comes back to the whole basis of IFRS 9, because when we designed IFRS 9, and it started even before I came back to the staff, so I didn't design the foundations, but I agree with the foundations, it was designed on the sort of hypothesis that only particular types of instruments can be sensibly accounted for using amortized cost accounting, whereas in theory everything can be accounted for measured using fair value through P&L. I think now people have sort of started to think that fair value through P&L is some sort of punishment that's imposed on them, and that wasn't the design of IFRS 9. So we were very careful in IFRS 9, and the reason why in IFRS 9 we've got this notion of solely payments of principal and interest and basic lending was because really amortized cost works best and well when you've got a really simple instrument with a definite maturity where it's just paying fixed rate interest or floating rate interest and nothing else fancy is going on. Now, people said to us in the letters, well, amortized cost can cope with catch-up adjustments. Sure, it can cope with catch-up adjustments, but that doesn't necessarily mean just because the mechanics work that that produces useful information. And the point we tried to make in the basis to the standard was, as soon as you start having any prepayments, whether they're positive or negative, you start to move away from the sort of nice pattern of interest earned over time to having spikes in P&L because of prepayments. And we're concerned about increasing the population of instruments for which that is true, particularly where the situations that we would be introducing would be more likely to be situations where the lender can be forced to take an early prepayment even when they don't really want it, have to then go and, you know, get new lending opportunities, take on the risks of that, and get back less than what they'd lent in the first place. That to me is not basic lending. So for people just to say to me, I consider that to be basic lending and the mechanics of amortized cost work, that's not really responding to the arguments that caused me to think I needed special conditions in the first place. So I think we're a bit of a risk at a risk of people saying, of sort of saying, do people agree or not, as opposed to were there new arguments that make me think about things differently, which is really the purpose of our comment letter process. So that was a rant. Also, people were unhappy because we made comments on the basis about, in particular, I think, prepayments at fair value and some comments about what sort of derivatives, etc., could be associated with instruments that are accounted for at amortized cost. And I want to react to that because I think some people are suggesting that we shouldn't be answering that question because all we were asked to answer was, is negative compensation okay or not? And that's all they want us to talk about because they like the answer to that. But I think we had to comment, and maybe we went too far by saying all prepayments at fair value are, you know, not accepted. Maybe we should say it's not automatically the case that all fair value prepayments are okay. So that's an open question. But we did need to comment, I think, on fair value prepayments for two reasons. Firstly, the submission that we got asked us actually two questions. The submission we got said if there's a prepayment that can result in negative compensation, either because of interest rate differentials or because of fair value movements, is that okay? We were actually specifically asked a question about fair value, so that's the first reason why we should be commenting on that. The second reason why we should be commenting on that is that particularly if we drop the second condition, which many people want us to drop, it puts all of the pressure on the gateway to amortised cost accounting on what this notion of reasonable additional compensation is. So if we're silent on that, we're just leaving completely open what reasonable additional compensation means. And if there's particular readings of that that we know are not actually consistent with what's already written in IFRS 9, which always said, so it's not new, a prepayment has to be solely payments of principal and interest or with the addition of reasonable additional compensation but nothing else, it's not okay. So it's not new stuff we came up with. The last rant I'll have is on transition. I was surprised people didn't give us more help on transition, and we tried to encourage them to do so, and even in meetings I attended, I told people it was important they gave us feedback on this. And that was because I sort of expected people to respond as they have, to say we'd rather have a later effective date with the right to early apply, and I completely understand why they want that, and I think they've raised a fair case for that. But it does introduce new complexities, because we're going to have situations where people will have, for example, already assessed their business model on the date of initial application of IFRS 9, and so we've then got new questions about whether they should be allowed, have to reassess the business model for those instruments if the words change for them in 2019. So there's lots of new questions, and people really didn't help us on that, so I was a bit disappointed in that. Where I think there were interesting comments was on the effectiveness and the clarity and the mechanics around that second test. So I'm not convinced that we don't necessarily still need an additional test for negative compensation, but I think some of the comments on the test itself were actually helpful.
Okay, now that you have that off your chest, Jungwoo?
Yeah.
I'm a little surprised that our 60 comment letters came to help us to discuss this issue. That's a very good feedback from our market to market. So I'd like to say thank you all those stakeholders to send us some emails. Some just clarification. I don't understand what they are saying. For example, the paragraph 9. Last sentence, some of these respondents stated the repayment features is negative compensation to provide protection for the parties to loan company against the change in interest rate in the activity. So they are saying this negative compensation is quite different from positive compensation in nature.
No, I think what they are saying is the purpose of this negative compensation is not to make a gain out of it. It's really to, if the prepayment were to occur, it's really to protect the lender from, for example, the reinvestment risk or the borrower in other circumstances.
So if that's the meaning of this negative compensation. So it's the same as the nature of positive compensation?
Because positive compensation will only compensate one party, the negative compensation will compensate either party depending on the market movement from the examples that we have seen.
Mm-hmm.
So there, I don't think this sentence, by making this comment, I don't think they are trying to distinguish positive or negative compensation necessarily, but they are just commenting why the negative compensation exists.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really not to make a gain out of fair value movements arising from that feature. It is really to protect if the prepayment were to occur.
Right.
So they,
they are trying to make a kind of a speculation gains and losses, then must be measured at fair value POL, right? So this kind of
we do not
use speculation or exposure to drive what should be the classification jungle. So that is where I would say this is a comment which they made, that saying that it's a commercial decision to protect the borrower and the lender and neutralize them for interest rate movements. Right. That's what they're saying, but I don't think that's what drives our classification.
Okay.
It isn't. IFRS 9 just asks what are the contractual cash flows, cash not flows. Why do you have them.
So I was a little confused with that comment and another comment in paragraph 25.
Yep.
Third sentence, maybe it starts with some says that if the prepayment amount includes compensation only for movement in the benchmark interest rate, blah blah blah, then the fair value might be more than insignificant. So I don't, just to give us some kind of inspiration, what this paragraph and the other paragraph 9, they are related to each other, or?
Sorry, what's the other paragraph?
The one you were asking? Yeah, about? No, I don't think so. Now they're talking about the valuation. Go on.
Mm. So what they are saying really is if there is a, let's say, loan charges the interest rate of LIBOR plus a margin, and what they are saying is if the compensation prepayment amount is only adjusted for the LIBOR component and leaves out the margin as is, if you calculate the fair value of that because of this fixed portion in the interest rate, they are saying that will create some fair value, and because of that we cannot demonstrate that fair value will be more than, fair value will be always insignificant in some cases if it's just the benchmark rate, not the whole interest rate that is adjusted.
I'm not sure where we are, but we will bring these statements back next time about the veracity of the statement. I personally don't agree with it, but we'll have to bring it back. But this is a comment which we
got. Okay.
So do you have a kind of possibility to think about these people are asking us to change the fair values and eligibility condition, you know, some people said, to the kind of a probability of exercise, low probability of exercise, because these some cases are the fair value of this payment option is more than, you know, insignificant amount. So I'm just curious about whether this is a valid claim of. Then we have the second paper where you will see that one of the things which you're asking is actually an analysis of this, of what is the veracity of the second
this committee. Paper just purely summarizes what we have heard. It doesn't have what we think about those comments.
Okay.
Mary.
Several points, and sorry, I know I'm making Kumar nervous by talking about financial instruments without having checked in advance. But one of the observations that struck me looking at this paper, and I think some of the fault is ours in terms of our communication, is I see in a number of places people arguing about whether you're reporting some of the analysis, looking at is this type of arrangement consistent with basic lending or not, as if basic lending were the threshold test. And when I just use my sophisticated markers of stray pencils, when I look at IFRS 9 itself, it says that the requirement is in 4.1.2b, contractual terms give rise on specified dates to cash flows that are solely payments of principal and interest. That is the requirement. It's only when you get to Appendix B where we make the observation that contractual cash flows that are SPPI are consistent with a basic lending arrangement, but basic lending arrangement is not the test. And I think we probably shorthand basic lending arrangement as an easy way to communicate, but that's why we may have had some of the responses that we got that said, here's the business reason why people do it, that's why the nature of this is consistent with a basic lending arrangement. And I think we have to think both about how we're communicating, but emphasize more, that the point is that here, you know, some of what Sue was saying in part one of her rant, that that the objective that the board considered originally is when do we think we reach the boundaries of the usefulness of amortized cost and effective interest rate. So it's not you should get to account for this type of operation on this basis, but it's what are the characteristics of transactions, and you know, SPPI is the threshold test. So while it was useful to get information about why people have why products might include these negative prepayment terms, one of the things I don't think I saw is anything that dispelled my concern that when you have these negative compensation terms, forget about why you included them. It does seem to increase the exposure of the reporting entity to changes in factors like interest rates that are not recognized, to changes that are not recognized in amortized cost accounting. And the more you're exposed as the entity, the more relevant that information becomes. And so knowing that this is the reason, I may have entered into something because of A, but if entering into it exposes me to risk three, then that might be more relevant. And I think we have to think about it that way. One of the things that troubled me when we were developing this amendment is when we move from positive to negative compensation, there's, I think, now a risk that an entity can be forced, as opposed to elect to, recover less than the carrying value produced by EIR. Because if it's only positive compensation, then presumably if you're going to take less than you have accrued, you know, as under amortized cost, it's because you as the entity, choose.
It's a choice.
Right. Yes. But if under negative compensation, the difference between positive and negative is we've now opened up a world in which the entity may be forced to accept less than the carrying value at the counterparty's choice. And I think that raises a significant question about the relevance of amortized cost in that consideration. And to me, that's a feature that makes negative compensation different. And I wondered, I don't think I saw anything in summary of feedback. I wondered if we'd had any people commenting about that risk of not recovering the carrying value. Okay, you're shaking your head, so I assume no.
I don't think we have.
That's why I expressed frustration, because they didn't respond. No, because they didn't respond to the argument. We set that out in the paper. And if people had arguments for why that shouldn't be a concern, I would have been interested to hear them. But they didn't respond.
People tell me how many vegetables I should eat, too, and I don't respond to that suggestion either.
But you know, that's the reason we've made a decision.
Yeah.
I think it's good to have a response.
Yeah. I had just three other scattered comments. Do you want those, or do you want...
The only thing we heard, absolutely right, Mary, we didn't hear any new reason than we had. And the reason which was there in the basis was the catch-up and the frequency which we had put in. And all we have heard that we are not convinced by that. That's it.
But again, I think we expressed it more in terms of the mechanics, and maybe not in, you know, not as much in terms of the concern about the relevance of the information that results. Okay, a couple scattered comments that maybe the staff can think about as you do the follow-up papers. If you look at 12C, there's a comment that some respondents thought that doing an interpretation or a clarification would be a more workable solution. And I think we have to remember, we have to remember and talk about these things not like it's a menu that we can choose from, but that rather what kind of action we take is based on our analysis of the, of the issue. And so that in this case, I think we as the board have concluded, and what I've seen in the feedback does not change my mind, that address, if we think that some subset of negative compensation should not preclude amortized cost accounting, then I think we have to undertake standard setting. So I think that's the only response we can have, so I don't want the staff to consider that one further in terms of Beirut. In 13A, I'm going to verge into rant territory here. At the end of 13A, the argument is it's okay because it's not explicitly prohibited. And I think I think it's right that you report what we heard, but I think it might be an opportunity for saying once again that you have to reason from the principles rather than say, because it's not explicitly addressed, there's uncertainty. And the last is, I think as regarding paragraph 17 and the issue that Sue touched on about the basis for conclusions and how much commentary, I think we absolutely have to comment on the basis about why we decided not to undertake standard setting in respect to prepayments at fair value. I think we should consider the comments we got about how much we say about that, but that is one of the key decisions that the board made in terms of scoping this project, and addressing that has to be reflected. But let's look at how much we said and how clearly we explained ourselves for that.
Stephen.
I agree with much of what Sue said and have similar concerns. I think there are some good things in the comment letters and some valuable information that we can use to develop this, but I was also frustrated by people seeming to think that this is sort of a rules-based game and let's try and push the rules because obviously a more tax cost accounting is better than fair value accounting, so the more we can get, the better. And a lack of reference to the fundamental principles of IFRS 9, which I think are very important and that we should be defending, because I think they were carefully constructed with the users in mind. So when is EIR, interest income, amortized cost accounting going to provide useful information for investors to help them assess the amount, timing, uncertainty of future cash flows, all those good things, and when is it not appropriate? And that's the important thing. And defending that boundary, I think, is very important. Now, I know people will read IFRS 9 in a rules-based type way, and they'll pour on the words, and where does it say I can't do this? But I think it's very important that we don't start going down a road that starts to bless accounting that contradicts those fundamental principles. And SPPI is very important because that interest income line is only going to be meaningful if you have SPPI type cash flows. And if there are significant sales, business model test, sales at fair value, then that also is going to result in a reduction in the usefulness of interest income in the meantime, and that the fair value is important. And this is why I think we have to be very careful with this amendment. And not to sort of just expand it or weaken it just because people say, you're too constrained. We've got to, whatever we do, we have to think about those fundamental principles. And I know it's challenging, and I know that the whole sort of prepayment at fair value issue and the way people have interpreted the reasonable additional compensation, and we've got to tread very carefully in what we do, but I think we've got to try and sort of always think back to the fundamental principles of IFRS 9 and why we think that amortized cost accounting is appropriate in some circumstances and not others.
What I found remarkable from the feedback is that apparently quite a few constituents thought that they could get at amortized cost for loans with prepayment features with existing IFRS.
There are quite a few interesting interpretations of 39 in there as well.
Gregor.
Chung mentioned the one suggestion from constituencies. Of course, we will discuss later about using threshold line, like no significant. I would feel we could consider, because in other areas we already consider in such a way would make us relatively easier. It relates to what Mary mentioned about the basic lending features, and I'm not sure what we can do. In my view, so I'm not sure whether I'm right, you know. From beginning, we never used basic lending feature type of notions when we developed NAM for classification and impairment purpose. And we use the characteristics and and another side is later on put in, that is the how to manage it, how to manage it, these two. But the problem, the reason why I bring in is because from beginning the FSB proposed ED on classification in line with lending, investing, and trading. And then we come together to improve jointly, and we have to use their notion, or combine their notion in our discussion. Now, this is my memory. But what I want to say is hard for us to do anything around the basic lendings. You know, it is a terms we use because of the joint efforts in the middle.
Actually, the reason why we added it was because in the original version of IFRS 9 that we published back in 2009, we said that interest could only be time value of money, credit risk, and liquidity. And so people said, well, if I read that literally, that means I can't make a profit and all of this other stuff. So we were forced to put in some more words to make people read it in a more reasonable way, to use the first word that comes into my head, to make it clear that things like profit were okay and your interest didn't have to be perfect, set on the day, you could have average rate over a week, that sort of stuff. And then we said, for example, so you couldn't have commodity price links, equity price links. But it was never meant to be a departure from the idea of solely payments of principal and interest.
Yes.
It was meant to be a word inserted to make sure that people were reading the words sensibly. But I think Mary's completely right that we've now got a massive challenge, because all of the time I hear people saying to me, but it's consistent with basic lending. And basic lending is meant to be solely payments of principal and interest, but now they're reading it to be this thing that if it's normal in the market, I'm allowed to do it. And this is a good opportunity for us to make sure that's not the case, because otherwise, NINE's not going to be applied anything like what we wrote and intended.
Can I just quickly come in? We'll bring it up. This also is reflected in the comment letters, Mary, not only on what I said, but in some of the comment letters, which we didn't come in, one of the key things which they argue why, even in the area of fair value or breakage costs, why anything should be allowed is because that's what's happening in the market. But I don't think that's what the intention of basic lending is. It's SPPI that's driving what you can consider basic lending.
It's clear from the construction of the standard.
Absolutely.
And sometimes we just have to step back. I mean, IFRS 9 is an immense thing to digest, and while people have had a number of years to do that, it still takes a while, and sometimes you just have to say, remember.
And I'm completely conscious of the fact that it's June 2017, not far away from 2018, and so in the spirit of getting people in the right space, I'm, you know, fine with that. But also we can't condone this wildly different reading of the standard that was not what we intended.
Amaru.
Excellent. First, I think it's commendable to see really 60 comment letters in such a short consultation period. I think it's really, as Xianhu also already mentioned, I think it's important to acknowledge that and thank people for their effort to comment. Just a few additional comments on the feedback. On paragraph 10, for instance, it's stressed that many respondents from Asia, Africa, and Latin America stated that those instruments are not very common. When reading the letters, and particularly Latin American ones, they sent four letters.
Yeah.
And although some countries stated that they were not common, all of them agreed with the proposal because they understood that this makes sense to be considered by us as an amendment to IFRS 9. Then comes to paragraph 12b, and then why I'd like just to reinforce the point here. It's really an exception. So it's sometimes an exception is difficult not to be rules-based.
Can't do it.
So, yeah, almost all the time when we decided to put an exception, we are establishing a rule. So I think we might be aware that this is almost all the time the case, and that's life. And let's comment on 13B on standard set accounting body standard set is not opposed to the proposal, but opposing to do amendments at this stage. Well, that's fine, but the proposal, it's at least as stated here, to wait until the post-implementation review, that's not really very helpful. So that's why we decided to propose an amendment at this stage. I think it's the way we are being responsive and helpful to people that are already in the process of applying IFRS 9, and I think it's important, at least to me, to let this very clear. We are not being irresponsible. We are being responsive to what is necessary at this stage, although we understand that might bring challenges for the ones who already are in the process of applying.
Doug? Thank you. I agree with Sue's comment, and it's a good opportunity to clarify the interpretation of basic lending and what is the interaction with SPPI and the fair value. However, if that is the case, 30 days comment period was a bit too short, because we are going to tackle a little bit ambitious things, because this kind of interpretation or clarification relates to the fundamental concepts of IFRS 9. And if we are
changed,
we are not changing.
We have not been changed at all.
We are not changing. However, actually, I heard that there are other consideration, and that there are people some saying that, say for example, B4.17A write about the basic lending, so other basic lending risk, for example, liquidity risk, and blah, blah, blah. And we already have such kind of literature. So therefore, my fear is it's fine to clarify now, and with a very short period of time, and the effective date quite soon. But we may face unintended consequences if we are too ambitious. And the original purpose of this amendment was to tackle the negative compensation issue. But I understand, of course, we now face the interpretation of what is the reasonable compensation and what is the term basic lending, what's the difference between SPPI, so what's the fair value. So it's a good opportunity to clarify. However, it's really ambitious, too ambitious to but do it in a short period.
It's just reaffirming
of
all the decisions that we've prior made during the development of IFRS 9, so it's...
Yeah, I do understand, but my concern is is IFRS 9 perfectly consistent with what we are discussing? That's the point. And if it is not, I think it would cause
so
more confusion.
So we should not make this exception?
Yeah, we should make no amendment then.
Then we should leave everything as it is.
Yeah, that's another choice, because we are trying to tackle this issue in this short period of time, and if it causes unintended consequences too much, then one of the choices is just to stop doing that. But of course, I don't think it's a good choice. I think we need to address the negative compensation issue at least. So that if that is the case, we should concentrate on the negative compensation issue, and knowing that there is some clarification issue about our fundamental interpretation of SPPI and the basic lending, then we can do it later on.
I don't want to
we jump into the debate which we're going to have next and what the two papers are. So that is a thing, and certainly that's something we will consider, but I don't think that completely that isolated, because it is based on what is reasonable validation or compensation. But acutely aware that where we are in time, the point in time, and what we are doing, so let's have that discussion next.
François?
Well, I had some outreach on the issue, so I met with a certain number of people. And the first thing I want to say is that the analysis of comments that we've received is fully in tune with what I heard. But maybe having had the opportunity to speak to people, to interact, maybe the comments do not get as dry to me as they seem to have reached a certain number of fellow members. So the first thing that I noticed from, that struck me in fact, and I was really positively impressed, was the fact that the SPPI test, first of all, is very well understood, and second, seems to work well. So when people have had difficulties with the basis for conclusions, they felt that the basis for conclusions was removing from them the ability of exercising judgment. And basically they were saying what we have in this basis for conclusions seems to bring definite answers, when with all the work that we have already done, because I mean the implementation of IFRS 9 is happily very well engaged, they have a concluding that sometimes yes and sometimes no. And if the way I understood it, that the rejection of this basis for conclusion was largely because it seemed to provide very definite answers. Now, moving back to the SPPI test and the amortized cost, Shui is perfectly right in reminding us what amortized cost is meant to do. However, I would like to make two comments. The first one is that amortized cost remains a present value, so you have changes that reflect the changes that you're facing in your business, in the business as it is characterized with the SPPI test. And so you have variations in and spikes in your profit and loss statement on certain occasions. You have the modifications, you have the changes in interest rates, you have it's not something that is set at the first day and never changes, obviously. When the board in IFRS 9, as my understanding, I was not there at the time, decided to accept that prepayment options could be, in certain circumstances, acceptable, considered as meeting the characteristic of the instrument test. It was, I think, out of two considerations. The first one was that these prepayment options are a common feature of the I don't want to say basic lending. of the loans, and that can meet the SPPI test, and the guidance that was provided was that the instruments and the option together should meet the SPPI test. But if it was a question of we should not accept circumstances in which you may have, I want also to highlight that it. The IFRS 9 today accepts that the prepayment option is at the option of the entity, but also at the option of the lender. As a result, I mean, we have already accepted that, despite the will of the bank, the customer is going to exercise it. So the issue that we are considering should not be considered differently, because this can happen because it's a circumstance that has already been accepted. So that the way I understood the comment that people made about these options, prepayment options with negative compensation, was as long as the instrument together with the option meet the SPPA test, then it should be a good candidate for amortized cost. And then you have the issue of the compensation. And I'm not sure I agree or I'm sensitive to the argument that you could receive less, because basically you have a change in you're not going to receive the totality of your last carrying amount, but because generally those options, if they are acceptable for the amortized cost, would be a reflection of interest rates. Basically, it's a change in interest rate that you're reflecting, and not the fact that it wouldn't be abandoning part of the principle. So I think, I mean, that's the way I understood it from people. The other thing that I heard, I don't think I read it in the comments, is that these, I think Uni mentioned the fact that it is developing on because it's considered as a protection for both parties. And what I heard is that it is indeed developing as one particular set of prepayment options. So I think people fairly comment on the fact that why would those with positive compensation, I'm not sure that the labels positive and negative compensation are very good descriptions, by the way. I think these options are economically very similar to the others. So they would like to have comparability in the reporting of this instrument compared to others.
I think we need a bit of prudential asymmetry.
I think we need a bit of prudential asymmetry here.
It's one thing if you have a choice to give some compensation.
Not if it goes to fair values right now.
What?
This is a case where people don't like it.
Yeah.
Hans, can I ask Françoise a question on her comments? Françoise, when you were working through the analysis, you were making the point that, and it may not have been clear, especially in the basis, that the IFRS 9, as issued, already accepts the concept of prepayment options in the document, and IFRS 9 today does not put a condition on it being, it does not require that it be exercisable only by the lender, but already says it could be exercised by either party. So there's no, you know, that's a pre-existing conclusion of the board in IFRS 9 that a prepayment option exercisable by either party is nothing new, and that's one of the things that people cite in terms of saying, is this, you know, what's special about negative, you know, the negative prepayment, while also noting that maybe negative and positive isn't, you know, aren't the most useful labels. Do you think people, from what you heard in your outreach, understood that it's that difference between negative and positive that's the big distinction that we were focused on in this amendment, rather than who exercises? Because it does go back to who exercises, in the sense that before either party could exercise, but if the borrower exercised, the lender was always going to get more. And the thing that is new with these negative, let's attach the label, it's not who can exercise, but it's rather that the borrower could exercise, and as a result of the borrower exercising, the lender could get less, so the lender doesn't have the same degree of control. So because I agree with you that the whole notion of prepayment feature is here, you know, exists before the amendment, but it's this difference about the risk of the potential for consideration flowing in the opposite direction, and that being the distinctive feature and whether that changes the analysis. And if people were just too focused on, but you already allow prepayment features, and you already allow prepayment features exercised by either party, that's nothing new. I think that doesn't capture the understanding of the difference between negative and positive and its impact for reporting. And do you think that people picked up on that negative versus positive being the key feature?
Oh yes, I met in fact different people. Some thought in fact that that no standard setting was necessary. So I met that those people. So but also discussed that, and the view I indicated is also the view of those who really thought that standard setting was necessary, because in the way the standard was written, you just could not get to the conclusion that amortized cost was eligible. But now, in fact, you yourself in your comments emphasized the fact that this could be triggered by the borrower itself. And it was just more a response to you people did not emphasize that at all, because basically that there is no difference.
When I spoke to people, and also from what I read in the letters, people didn't really comment on that.
No.
The only thing they focused on was the fact that the mechanics work the same, so why wouldn't you just let us do it?
And I was asking because it was one of the things Francoise raised in her comments, but
the main point, I think, which to me is very convincing, is the fact that the key issue is that when you analyze the instrument and the option together, it meets the SPPI test without any sort of leverage, gaming, or the like.
Sorry, which one? The negative and the one we are considering now, Fonso?
By definition.
By definition, it doesn't.
One of my comments for this meeting, when you ask whether what should be redeliberated, I personally think that one thing that should be redeliberated is whether it is an exception. To me, it's clear that you can't do it with IFRS 9 written as is. But saying that it is an exception, it's different from what is written, doesn't mean that it is an exception to the characteristic of the instrument test. And in fact, in paragraph 12 of the analysis comments, you state that many commentators would want this to be reconsidered, not presented as an exception, because they see that as weakening the possible understanding of the SPPI test. So as losing one of the benefits that some of you believe is not there. In fact, IFRS 9 and SPPI test is working very well, and it's well understood. And making you say this is not, because the intellectual articulation is a bit difficult to follow. You say this does not meet the SPPI test. However, to be acceptable, you must have cash flows which are only interest and principal. What is the SPPI test if that's not it? So you say you're not meeting it, but you can apply amortized cost if you meet it. Okay. Intellectually, it is very difficult to follow. So one point that I would like us to discuss is whether it needs standard setting, it needs full explanation of why negative compensation, if we keep calling it that way, is a particular issue. But to me, the question, I am convinced that we will weaken the understanding of the SPPI test by saying that, stating this as an exception. And I would like us to redeliberate that.
Daryl?
So quite a lot has been said, I think, on the contents of the letters and what we received. I wouldn't want to add to that, but I agree with most of what's been said in that space. I think we also had a couple of discussions on the technical merits, and because Kumar asked us not to, I won't say anything about that part yet. There were a couple of things that surprised me. I like Francois did a little bit of outreach, but unfortunately did outreach in what now appears to be the wrong part of the world, where everybody was telling me they didn't have these products. So,
these products don't exist.
Yeah. So what did surprise me a little bit in reading the comment letters and in reading the views here was this idea that these products are quite common. And I think if I were to rewind back, and this has a few implications for a few other things, if I were to rewind back to what I was thinking or my perception at the time that this issue was raised, that we saw it as a relatively narrow issue, specifically raised very late in the process because it hadn't been one that was in general space, raised in such a way or brought to our attention in such a way that we believed it would have a very narrow impact on the way people were implementing the standard. We did believe, though, that in those cases where it kicked in, it had a big impact, so we thought it made sense to do it. What seems to be coming through in the comment letters, at least from some of the regions, is that this is actually a common issue. There are lots of products in this space, and that some of the types of products that are being brought to the fore are products I wouldn't have expected to see, like aircraft loans, which I hadn't expected would be subject to this type of process. So it gives rise to a couple of questions. The first one is do we think that the way we have defined the scope of what we're looking at may have been broader than what we were perhaps originally thinking about, or that the way that our definition is being interpreted might be broader than what we were originally thinking about? Or is this simply an issue that a lot of people have opportunistically, who may have been comfortable with the outcome under the previous, have now seen the opportunity to get a different outcome to what they had? I think the answer to that is important, and just understanding the type of loans that are being dragged in. Because, say, I had in my mind, there was a fourth option there, that my perception in the first instance was completely wrong, which is entirely possible too. What it does seem to do is now we're suddenly talking about, and if I look at some of the amendments that are people suggesting, these seem to be broadening even more the impact of this change. So I start to get into the space where, to perhaps Tuck's point, I start to question the basic premise of what we were trying to do. A narrow surgical change that would affect a limited number of transactions in very specific circumstances. Everything else we're hearing now says it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that leads me back to the option that I think Tuck put on the table, which is I don't think we should take off the table, is I think if we want to keep this narrow, if we believe that we want a surgical change that is, we should be very careful to open new topics, very careful to go beyond the mandate of what we were originally trying to solve. And we need to keep on the table the view that if we're doing too much harm, stop. Leave what's there, leave what's in place, and let it rest in that space.
Tom?
Could I ask a question? Sorry, I apologize, it was answered somewhere in the documents. In these contracts that are out there, and we're talking about, I guess sometimes either the lender has the option of forcing a prepayment or the borrower has an option of forcing or presenting a prepayment.
Both have it.
And I was curious about, in the universe of these things, how often is it symmetric? Either one in the contract literally says either one can bring it, the lender can bring it, or the borrower can bring it. Do we have a census on this?
You mean proportion of numbers?
Yeah, just rough.
We don't have exact idea, but I think based on what we understand, the borrower held option is more of the focus.
It's more of the common. So, and I guess, I'm sort of sitting in here, I think, maybe I should just ask the question. I'll ask one more demographic and maybe I'll come back later. If whoever has it, how often is this sort of side payment there? Because you could just have the right and, you know, the just says, you know, whatever the dollar is. Or you could actually say, if you do this, one of the two parties has to make a payment. Like, do we know, again, how much, to what degree do they sort of lay out this sort of compensation?
Can I see if you understand the question? Let me rephrase. So if there's an option which can go either way, so the borrower might receive or it might have to pay even if it's struck, you're asking how often is it that the negative payment happens?
Yeah, well, and or even is it you could dice it two ways. That's my question. I'll sort of throw an extra one in. Does it tend to fall one side or the other? Does it just tend to fall lender, borrower, as opposed to negative, positive?
I'm not sure I understand the second bit that much. On the side of where these, how often they're struck, difficult from some of the things where we have spoken to some of the banks where it is there, the borrower held and everything. The way it is designed, they're designed to be pretty punitive so that they're not struck very often and they have conditions attached to them. So one of the key reasons why these prepayment options have low fair value is that if struck, there's a large cash flow, but the probability of them being struck is very low. So they make it quite punitive. So, but don't think we have been, or is it, I'm not sure it's possible to split it out to see how much of that is negative historically based on empirical data and how much of that is positive.
I just want to try to get a sense of the demographics.
But I think when it does happen, from what I understand, and Tom, if I'm wrong, because you've been doing talking to people more than I have, if the borrower's got the right to prepay, often if there's negative, it's positive as well, right?
Yes.
So it tends to be the case that it's trying to make it neutral for rate movements, sort of from a borrower perspective, if you like. That's why it's in jurisdictions where it exists, it's quite common because it's sort of a consumer protection type.
Yes.
So if rates move against you, you suffer, but if it moves for you, you benefit. So it's sort of symmetrical in that sense, I think, where it tends to exist.
For what it is, Tom, just to clarify, when it's an option where, if struck, what happens is when the jurisdictions like customer protection and everything other than commercial, which is aircraft leases and everything, which is the biggest, the volume is bigger in retail space where it happens. When it is struck, effectively what is that it is linked with other factors, so it is not, how shall I put, just interest rates movements. You can strike it and get a compensation. So even if the lender has to strike it or the borrower has to strike it, there are conditions attached. So you might be have to sell your house or move house and things like that. So there are additional conditions attached. And one of the things also coming up, and we will discuss that when we come, is appropriate. It is what we are also hearing is that when we look at it, and I've looked at some valuation models, a large part of the fair value is driven by positive compensation to the borrower, because that's when it is, when usually empirically that's what people are telling us, that's what it's for.
But we're talking about adding in the negative compensation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, even with that, but the main driver of the value of these options is the positive compensation to the which the borrower receives.
Mary?
Just going back to Daryl's comment and his concern that the instruments affected by this may be a broader population than he expected originally. I think I agree with him in terms of thinking about that as how much can we do, is it surgical? But I think an alternative or maybe additional way to think about that comes back to effective date, and so that may be the other place where we reflect on our learning in terms of the population of the number of instruments, because when our thinking was saying mandatory for 2018 was that people who had, there is a relatively limited population who had this and would be affected. So, that may be the other kind of trade-off to think about. So I just, if the staff can think about that point in relation to effective date.
Martin?
Yeah. I agree also what Sue has said, and I also share some of the, I would not say frustration, but I think what people have written to us, that I think it is not the time now that we, in this discussion of a limited thing now, discussing overall, okay, how people now should interpret this SPBI, because we are, as also who has said, we are very close to the effective date, and I think it's not the time now that we do that. And I think we should address this limited thing here, which I think most of the people have said, okay, we should do it, it's a good thing, so we should do that. And based on my reading of that, they have two big issues. One issue is it is not the time now in the basis of conclusion or in other kind of documents now to discuss what SPBI is and how it should interpret it. Even if I think we have concerns that maybe some people have done it wrongly, I think I would say it is not the time to do that now. Secondly, I think they have said, okay, about the second condition, which we have said, that is a main, second main argument, and I think we can, we should discuss it. Is it still necessary, or are there other measures which we can do, maybe to limit the scope of these instruments? But I would really think, because when I, what I heard about this discussion today, we should not have now in July and September and October all this kind of detailed discussion about SPBI and things. I think that is not helpful. And therefore, I think we should concentrate on this issue and not on a broader discussion of, even if these instruments also from the beginning would be qualified as SPBI, because already, as the introduction has said, it will not qualify.
Yeah.
So it is designed, it's done. Why should we discuss it again?
Yeah.
So that is my concern, because my time is running. We should stick to that and to this. And I think it is an exception. We all know it is not fulfilling SPBI, it is a kind of exception. And the exception is, my rationale is it a kind of basic lending? Because that is my thinking. Because banks using that in the basic lending arrangement, therefore should we grant this exception, because it does not fulfill SPBI. And that is, I think, what we should concentrate on. And it's difficult to have the scope then, because we have heard that maybe other kind of, or more loans are granted in this way that we have thought, but I think that is something I think we should do in the next and in July meeting and concentrate on that, but not have a general discussion on how SPBI should be interpreted.
Okay.
Can I move to the second paper?
Yeah.
Which already we have discussed a bit of it, but yes.
So the second paper sets out the key issues that the staff plan to consider for the board's redeliberation. Recognizing the urgency of this issue, the project timetable has been set very tightly to allow the finalization as soon as possible. For the board to be in the position to finalize the amendment by the end of October, we think it is very important to establish a common understanding on what issues needs to be discussed in the redeliberation at the July board meeting, and the objective of this paper is to achieve that. As set out in paragraphs 4 to 9 of this paper, the staff plan to bring an analysis around the two eligibility conditions, in particular, whether the board should proceed with the proposed condition or whether it should be amended, whether any particular aspects of the board's conclusion relating to reasonable additional compensation for early termination of the contract should be clarified, and the discussion around the interaction between the existing exception in B4112 and the proposed amendment. And as set out in paragraphs 10 to 14, the staff plan to bring an analysis around the effective date and transition. If the board sets an effective date as later than IFRS 9, there may be a need to consider additional transition provisions and disclosures. Paragraph 15 of this paper lists all the key issues that the staff plan to analyze for the July board meeting. So at this point, I'd like to ask the board whether the board agree that the list captures all the key issues that needs to be discussed in order to finalize the amendments.
This is critical. We have one shot at this.
I agree.
One shot at this.
Great work.
I think we are now in dilemma. From beginning, we considered the previous, the original, the paragraph is an exception. I'm on Francois' side, and this is why, from beginning, I will support to do so. But when I firstly see these issues, I always feel, like Francois said, in principle, this should be like this, and positive, negative is okay for me. And then we now consider the original paragraph as exceptions, and now we want to consider the negative side. It seems quite, off, and I'm not sure whether we can conclude
more effective way. I'm not sure whether there is any possibilities to take Francois's ideas. I think, as I agree with her, and consider exception, and actually, you know, in his term, you know, be not considered as exception will enhance the SBI notion. And I like the idea. I'm not sure where, how can we do, you know, but I like the idea.
Sorry, because I just wanted to clarify, because this is critical. We have one shot and we need to bring whatever you all need to make a decision at the July meeting. What are you proposing? We bring something on why is this an exception to SPPI, or we shouldn't? Because we've also got to balance it with the concerns which Martin and also the comment letters raised, that this is not the time to go and re-deliberate everything. So we wanted to focus it on the two aspects which are there in the basis for conclusion on fair value put and the hedge break cost, what has been commented. So that's why I wanted to clarify, how much do we bring on this? Because to open up what is SFPI will be challenging at this juncture.
No, we should definitely not go there. Yeah. Françoise?
I don't think that I suggested that we should revisit the SPPI test or the SPPI principle. That was not my point. I think we need to agree on a text that fully explains why, in the first place, these instruments are contrary to this PPI test. Because, so, and that will justify the fact that it is an exception. In doing that, we will see whether we write something that is understandable.
Fair enough.
I think we'd have to watch for massive unintended consequences.
It's a paper that you had not in your list, and I think it is essential to help people understand.
Okay, fair enough.
Including me.
You try.
I think the concern that we heard, particularly in the comment letters, about risk of unintended consequences is probably more focused on what we end up saying in the final document, including the basis, and maybe slightly less so in terms of analysis that's brought to the board for discussion in a board paper. So there may be, subject to the constraints of time and not having a wandering discussion that throws up more dust. I think there is maybe an ability to work through some of those issues in our discussion and then pause and think about how much of that we try to ultimately capture in a document that avoids the risk of unintended consequences and how we express it. And when I'm looking at these, I think I agree that a discussion on the three areas, two eligibility, effective date, and transition, those are the right subjects, but I think you heard several things in the discussion today that probably fall under one of those headings that we should bring. So I don't think I want to suggest new subjects that you bring, but make sure that you pick up some of the arguments.
Other comments?
Please.
Okay.
Thank you.
We take a break till 1 o'clock.